We are talking today with Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He has reported from more than 50 countries and has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, the New York Times, for which he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years, and was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. He is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City and has taught at Columbia University, New York University, and Princeton University, and he currently teaches inmates at a correctional facility in New Jersey. He has written 9 books, including Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, I Don't Believe in Atheists, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right, and The War on America. And he is here today to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing Death of the Liberal Class?
Well, it originally began as a book for Knopf on the press. And when I turned the manuscript in, Knopf hated it. I think Knopf and I were in agreement that the destruction of the mainstream press is catastrophic, but they were uncomfortable with my critique of it, its failings, which, frankly, I think I knew a lot better than Knopf did. And they offered to take the negativity out of the book for me and publish it. And you can imagine how that went over. And so I sold it to another publisher. And when I was writing the book, I kept bumping into the fact that the press hardly existed in a vacuum, that it was one of the major pillars of liberalism, classical liberalism, and that its demise and collapse had been replicated by the other pillars of the liberal establishment, the church, the liberal church, universities, arts, labor, and, of course, the Democratic Party. And so I broadened the book to look at liberalism as a whole, what had happened to it, and the consequences of the withering away of these liberal institutions within our civic democracy.
All right. So when did the liberal class begin this death spiral?
I think you have to go back to World War I, which I do in the book, and look very closely at the powerful progressive and populist movements that were reconfiguring American society on the eve of World War I. We had a strong socialist movement, radical labor unions, the power elite, the wealthy power elite was in retreat. A few dozen socialist mayors across the country and many in fairly large cities. Publications like Appeal to Reason, the masses, had very wide circulation. And as the great political theorist Dwight MacDonald wrote, the war was the rock on which these movements broke. And what happened in World War I had a profound impact on the coloring of American society. The war was not popular. Wilson, in fact, had run for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But the bankers, Wall Street, once again, which had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, were terrified that if the Germans won the war, they would not get their loans repaid. They would not get their money back. And so they pushed us into the war. And Wilson had terrible recruiting problems, and there was tremendous opposition to the entrance in the war. And they created the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, which had a kind of diabolical brilliance. And figures like Walter Lippmann, who comes off in his book Public Opinion, which is a really foundational text for how to, as Lippmann calls it, manufacture consent. They built a system of propaganda that crossed all disciplinary lines. They had a news division. They had a film division that practically paid for itself, you know, producing, the Kaiser, the Butcher of Berlin kind of movies. graphic artists, they had speakers bureaus. But more importantly, they employed the understanding of mass psychology that had been explored by Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud and Edward Bernays, who is considered sort of the father of modern public relations, was in the Committee for Public Information. He was actually Freud's nephew twice over. And it was this understanding that people are not moved by fact or reason. They're moved by the skillful manipulation of emotions. People can confuse knowledge for how they are made to feel. And so when you read writers like Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, who held out against this war fervor, much of their despair is not only about how essentially the masses were seduced by the war propaganda, but the intellectual class itself. Wilson pushed through the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, but in fact he didn't have to use overt repression against most of the society. It was only that marginal fringe which refused to cooperate with the war effort, and of course this landed figures like Eugene Debs eventually in prison. After the war, two things happened. This massive propaganda machine, which interestingly was very closely studied by Goebbels and the Nazis. Bernays' book Propaganda was one of the instrumental books that Goebbels used to build the Nazi propaganda movement. You had the dreaded Hun instantly replaced with the dreaded Red, and you saw the more overt legislation like the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act used to crush the remnants of radical populist movements with the Palmer Raids and publications like Appeal to Reason, although it had been forced to support the war and its editorial policy during the war was shut down along with the masses. And all of these figures moved to Madison Avenue like Bernays and began working for corporations, saturating American society, upending traditional American values of thrift and self-effacement to replace it with the values of mass consumption, to instill consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. We began a culture that, again, MacDonald refers to as the culture of permanent war, where there's always an enemy, external and internal, the whole sort of Cold War ideology, which became an effective mechanism to cow the population into passivity and purge those elements within society that retained a kind of radical critique of structures and assumptions. So you had a decimation of populist movements, labor movements and independent press. Liberal institutions would carry out purges within themselves because of this sort of fear of being pink or being red. The population itself, locked into kind of the psychology of fear, accepted an increasing intrusion of the state into their lives. As Randolph Bourne wrote, you know, war is the health of the state. And I think we've never recovered from that. The political and social theorists of the late 19th century, including Karl Marx, never grappled with the concept of mass propaganda and permanent war. It wasn't something that was on their radar screen. And that was really the start of our descent.
Was there any real resistance to this from any of the different sectors that you identified that make up the liberal class?
If you read Malcolm Cowley's great book, An Exile's Return, which is an intellectual history of the period, he argues, I think correctly, that when you look at the Bohemians and later the Beats and even the New Left in the 1960s, the core values that they embraced were the values that had been inculcated into the American public by public relations firms and corporations, values of hedonism, the cult of the self, which was a radical departure. I think that what the public relations industry that was, of course, serving corporate interests was able to do quite effectively was destroy American culture or American cultures, because we once had many cultures, ethnic cultures, regional cultures, with their own sense of identity and self-expression, so that there was an homogenization of American culture and a reconfiguring of the values of that culture. And I think it's probably better described as corporate culture. That's what was bequeathed to us. Now, we saw, of course, in the 1930s, the breakdown of capitalism. And that was a dramatic illustration of why liberal institutions and the liberal class are vital to a state. Because they provide channels or mechanisms within the power structure by which the grievances and suffering of large sectors of the population can be addressed. So we still had vibrant labor unions, although they'd suffered. We had progressive Democrats, people like Henry Wallace and Roosevelt himself, who pushed through the New Deal. And as Conrad Black in his biography of Roosevelt correctly points out, what Roosevelt did in essence was save capitalism. After World War II, strikes were illegal during the war, although there were many, but there was a series of strikes right after the war, a kind of rebirth of labor, and they passed, in the name of anti-communism, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948, which was probably the most destructive piece of labor legislation until NAFTA. And then, of course, we began with Joe McCarthy, and it's interesting that George Creel, who ran the Creel Commission for Wilson, ended his career working for McCarthy and Nixon in the House Un-American Affairs Activity Committee. So you had then a ruthless purging of, and it's not fair to call them communists, but people who practiced a kind of moral autonomy, socialists, people who didn't buy into the narrow, rigid Cold War ideology. Thousands of professors and high school teachers and social workers lost their job. That's how America's greatest journalist of the 20th century, I.F. Stone, became a pariah. He couldn't even get a job at The Nation magazine, finally, and starts printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement with his wife. And so those last remnants were decimated, and the liberal class itself, even institutions like the ACLU, willingly bought into these witch hunts. And who is it that carried out the witch hunts? Well, they were the careerists. They were the people with the least sort of moral core who were willing to denounce, you know, many of their colleagues who didn't embrace this kind of orthodoxy. So as we saw the rise of the corporate state, deregulation, unfettered capitalism, we had lost the radical movements that could give us the kind of language of class warfare and the broad critique and the militancy to fight back. And we had also lost the liberal institutions who once played this very important role of balancing power between populist movements and the power elite itself. And we saw with the rise of Bill Clinton a very calculated effort to seek corporate money and do corporate bidding. Clinton knew that labor and the working class had nowhere else to go. And with the passage of NAFTA, the deregulation of the FCC, so-called welfare reform in 1996, the destruction of our banking system. Canada doesn't have a banking crisis because Larry Summers didn't rip down the firewalls. Larry Summers like figured and ripped down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks. And so that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans. And by the time Barack Obama ran for president, the Democrats got more. But they sold out the working class. They sold out traditional liberal values. We've had a frightening consolidation of the press, of the commercial media, the corporate press. There's roughly six corporations that control just about everything most Americans see, watch, read, or hear. That's Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Viacom, General Electric, Disney. Universities have become corporatized. Withering of the humanities. Whole departments are forced often to find funding not only for their own research and grants, but their own salaries. So you have a slashing of philosophy departments, theater departments. University of Albany just abolished classics along with most foreign languages, German, Italian, French. And schools become increasingly vocational, especially state schools where you have budget cuts. You can get corporations to fund your business school, but they're not going to pay for students to read Camus. And so there's been and of course accompanying that is a decline of labor unions. I live in the state of New Jersey, and our governor is very busy dismantling the teachers' unions. The last readout of union strength is in the public sector. And even that is being decimated.
So do you believe the power elite, for lack of a better term, and the corporations had this plan from the start, or was it, you know, multiple corporations and wealthy people kind of each doing it piecemeal and just worked out well?
Well, there's always been a deep hostility to populist movements that inhibited the ability to make maximum profit. And the assault on the universities began at the turn of the century with figures like Mellon and Carnegie, who wanted to train young people to serve business and hated the fact that they were being educated in the liberal arts, which is, of course, if it's done right, is meant to challenge assumptions and structures and ask uncomfortable questions and critique the status quo. And of course, at its core, it's about values. So it's not a new phenomena, but they altered and adjusted their tactics. You saw in the 1960s a very concerted effort to bring down Ralph Nader with a Powell memo. Lewis Powell eventually ended up on the Supreme Court, which I reprint in the book. And he brought in tremendous amounts of resources and corporate money, created the Business Roundtable, along with these conservative foundations, which, you know, ended with the collusion of the Democratic Party, Nader becoming a kind of pariah in American society. So I think that these inclinations are not new, but it's been a long process because they have had to slowly dismantle the barricades that prevented unfettered capitalism from reconfiguring American society into a kind of neo-feudalistic state, which is rapidly what we are becoming now. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class. NAFTA saw the kind of final destruction of our manufacturing base. There are whole pockets of the United States that resemble the developing world. I just did a story for The Nation magazine on Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not coincidentally the most dangerous. And there are no jobs, literally no jobs. And Camden was once an industrial hub. It once had a huge shipyard. RCA Victor was there. Campbell Soup was there. All gone. 5,000 abandoned buildings, 100 open-air drug markets, 77% of the city budget is spent on police and fire. And these post-industrial pockets are spreading outwards. There's no supermarket in the center of Camden because agribusinesses have created a system by which fruits and vegetables, if you live in the state of New Jersey, are shipped across country, and poor people can't buy tomatoes. So they don't sell it to them. We are creating a kind of permanent underclass. And it's especially as state and federal programs are slashed. I mean, we are now facing the very real prospect that unemployment benefits will not be extended. And many people will have to attempt to survive on the $143 a month you receive from welfare, courtesy of the Democratic Party and Bill Clinton. The danger of closing that kind of safety valve that liberal institutions and the liberal class provided is that as discontent grows, it is expressed in very anti-democratic form. And we are seeing that already with the Tea Party and militia movements. Coupled with a rage against government is a rage against liberals. And I think that rage is not misplaced. I think the liberal establishment, which continues to speak in the language of traditional liberalism, has betrayed the very people that they purportedly defend, whose interests they defend. And I watched the breakup of Yugoslavia, the collapse of Yugoslavia, and I find very many similar parallels. You can go back and look at the collapse of Tsarist Russia. Dostoevsky is obsessed with this collapse of liberalism. It's what Notes from Underground is about. It's what Demons is about. It's the underground man, the defeated dreamer, that figure who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," then feels betrayed and says, well, only the buffoons and the idiots take over, and removes themselves from social engagement. And when that happens, Dostoevsky argues, your society descends into what he calls an age of moral nihilism. And I'm terrified. The same withering away of the liberal establishment is what permitted buffoonish and ridiculous figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman to be vomited up from the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. And we're not immune from that at all. So the although I'm very critical of the liberal establishment because it certainly in the end serves the interests of the power elite. One of the prime functions and the reasons the power elite tolerates liberal institutions is because they are the most effective attack dogs against radicals. I mean, I think the figure that self-identified liberals probably detest most is not Glenn Beck, but Noam Chomsky, because he calls them out on this. You can see it in when they do the retrospectives of the war in Iraq. You know, you had the liberal establishment, including my former editor at the New York Times, Bill Keller, identifying themselves as reluctant hawks. It pains me to do this, but it's the right thing to do. Well, that's the classic role of the liberal establishment. And now in the retrospectives of the war, they say, well, we weren't prepared for the insurgency, we weren't prepared for the occupation, but our motives were pure. We went in to bring democracy and stop genocide and create liberty. And that is the classical role of liberalism. You don't cross those parameters of questioning the intent of the power elite itself. And if you do that, then you are thrust outside of liberal institutions very quickly.
So there's a difference between the liberal class and the liberal establishment. Liberal establishment sounds like it's still surviving to a degree.
Well, but it doesn't function anymore. They've reduced themselves to the role of courtiers because they have no power. And Obama is, for the last 2 years of the Obama administration, is a perfect example of the bankruptcy of American liberalism, because the Democrats came in and, in essence, codified the destruction of domestic and international law that was put in place by the Bush administration, not only in terms of the furtherance of our imperial projects, the preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression. Not only did they continue the looting of the U.S. Treasury on behalf of Wall Street speculators and swindlers who committed crimes through mortgage brokers and bankers, filling out fraudulent loan applications, giving money to people who they knew could never pay it back, and then selling these bundled derivatives as assets. The Obama administration has not confronted this severe dislocation that has been visited on millions of American citizens, 2.8 million people who lost their homes last year from bank repossessions and foreclosures, matched by another 3 million this year. The so-called health care reform bill is a sham. It's the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the for-profit health care industry, essentially $400 billion in subsidies for the pharmaceutical and insurance corporations. And now we're sitting around watching them grant exemptions because these corporations don't want to insure chronically ill children, on and on and on. And one of the things that the right wing is doing very well is tarring Obama, not only as a liberal, but they're calling him a socialist, because it is a way to discredit the values. And the sad fact is that the very destructive forces, corporate forces that created the mess, because of an anemic liberal class, will benefit from the misery that they created. I mean, you saw the New Yorker just ran this long piece on how the Koch brothers are, you know, pumping tremendous amounts of sums into the Tea Party and deflecting attention away from Wall Street towards government, with very disturbing undertones of racism towards Obama and racism towards undocumented workers and Muslims. I mean, it's the classic finding, you know, channeling that rage or directing that rage towards weak scapegoats. And, you know, we live in a period of relative stability, but the worldwide currency crisis is serious. If you look at the recent front pages of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and what's happening to the euro and countries like Ireland and Italy and potentially Spain, we're not immune from that. I mean, we're playing a very desperate game trying to monetize our debt with $600 billion, which means, in essence, we're printing $600 billion of money. And there's debate, and I'm not an economist, but there's debate across the spectrum as to whether or not it will work, but there is no debate over the fact that if it does not work, the consequences could be catastrophic. You know, they want to create inflation, but can you create inflation and prevent hyperinflation? Can we sustain a level of consumption and an empire through the selling of debt forever? We sell $2 billion of debt a day to the Chinese with $12.8 trillion in deficits, the largest, I think, in human history. That's about 96 to service that will be about $96 billion a week we'll have to sell. And if it China and the oil-rich nations don't buy it, then we're the Federal Reserve will buy it, which means we'll just print more money. It's not a sustainable solution over the long run. And if it all goes south, then, as I saw in Yugoslavia, where we endured hyperinflation on the eve of the war and massive unemployment and large-scale factory closures, if it all goes south, then those that economic catastrophe will empower a very frightening right-wing populism, which we are already seeing gravitate towards the centers of power with the midterm elections. And it's not coincidental that the environmental crisis is twinned with the economic crisis, because corporations view everything, human beings and the natural world, as commodities that they exploit until exhaustion or collapse. So we stand by and we face, I mean, even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, we would still rise to about 550 parts per million, 350 parts per million being, you know, that amount which has sustained the human species throughout our history. And we stand by as the industrialized nations and corporations go to Copenhagen and shred Kyoto, as if climate change isn't real, as if it's not happening. So the consequences of an unchecked corporatism, both for us as a nation and finally for the planet itself, are deadly. I mean, quite literally. And the normal mechanisms by which civilians or citizens can be heard have shut down. We've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion. And they've won, and we've lost.
So would it be fair to say that you see that if we do go over this abyss with the economy, either in the U.S. or worldwide, I mean, they're both going to go together, basically, that we could look at fascism taking over this country?
I think so. It will come in an American guise, who, you know, be wrapped in the American flag and clutching the Christian cross. I spent 2 years writing a book on the Christian right called The American Fascist, The Christian Right in the War in America, And I come out of the church. My father was a minister, and I graduated from seminary. I don't look at this movement as a religious movement. They're Christian heretics. They've utterly perverted and deformed the message of the gospel, acculturating it with the worst aspects of American chauvinism, greed, bigotry. And like all totalitarian movements, removed people from a reality-based world. That's the attraction of the movement. And it was interesting carrying out dozens and dozens of interviews of followers who I came to have a great deal of empathy for. The stories of severe financial distress, struggles with substance abuse, domestic and sexual violence, all of the attendant problems that come when communities break down drove these people to profound despair. And so they retreated into a world of magic and miracles and destiny and very authoritarian church structures, led inevitably by white male figures who are in direct contact with God and who cannot be questioned. And when you get inside these megachurches, they have a cult-like quality to them. You have to get beyond the sort of the propagandistic quality, which the face that they show to the outward world, including in their church service, and get into the women's groups or the men's groups or the creationist seminars, and then you see it, and then it becomes a form of indoctrination, essentially breaking people. And I think you see that same kind of emotional consistency coupled with utter irrationality within the agenda of the Tea Party itself. Government's part of the problem, but the military is exempt as if somehow it's not part of government. We want to cut taxes and reduce deficits. We want government out of our lives, but don't touch Social Security. The political agenda is completely irrational, but like the Christian right itself, it provides a route to direct rage and a simplified worldview that is reduced to easily digestible cliches and slogans and jargon that fundamentally don't make sense if you're rooted in a reality-based world. And we still live in a period of relative stability. The U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency, and then Bernanke and others and Geithner or Summers are banking on the fact that they can play around with it because they have that power. But if they are proven wrong, then everything could get upended. And at that point, we just don't have, either within the liberal establishment or, outside that establishment, we don't have the mechanisms, as we had in the 1930s, to fight back. In the 1930s, there was tremendous sympathy and support for fascism in Europe by huge industrialists, people like Henry Ford and others. Mussolini was on the cover of Fortune magazine and praised for the defanging of labor unions. And we didn't go the other way because we had enough indigenous movements and organizations that fought back in a way that could use government to ameliorate the suffering of the American public. Well, now all of that's gone. And so if we descend into another period like that, we've essentially been stripped of the tools by which we can respond. And then you end up with a kind of perverted American Christian fascism. I'm a great admirer of the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, probably our greatest living political philosopher. He taught at Berkeley and later at Princeton. And in his book, Democracy Incorporated, he describes the system we currently live under as inverted totalitarianism, which is not classical totalitarianism. Classical totalitarian movements are built around radical or reactionary forces that overthrow decaying structures and replace them. In inverted totalitarianism, you find the expression of that system in the anonymity of the corporate state that purports to pay fealty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet is so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizenry impotent. And in inverted totalitarianism, economics always trumps politics. In classical totalitarianism, politics trumps economics. And I've spoken with Wolin. He argues that the way the masses are kept in check is through credit, which of course has dried up. Real wages for 90% of American workers have seen a steady decline since the early 1970s, and mass-produced goods. Well, the credit is gone, and the mass-produced goods are becoming harder and harder to afford. And I asked, if those two mechanisms of control vanish, could we flip into a period that would resemble classical totalitarianism? And he agreed that we could. I've watched disintegrating states. It was my job to report about them. And I think many of us take for granted how fragile open societies are and how easily they are decimated.
I think one of the key mechanisms there for why we do is from the corporate propaganda system that's been kept from us through universities, television, you name it.
Well, it's all, you know, we are fed across the political and cultural spectrum this fantasy that reality is never an impediment to what we desire. We can have everything we want. That's given to us by Oprah or the Christian right or positive psychologists or self-help gurus or Hollywood. And what that does is essentially keep you in a state of perpetual infantilism. You never grow up. But as that gap opens up between this illusion of who we think we are and where we're going and the hard reality that we face, when it's our home that is foreclosed, when we realize that that job we lost is never coming back, and not only that, but that good jobs are not going to be offered to our children, then we're unprepared emotionally, psychologically, intellectually, and we react as children. We search for a demagogue or a savior, someone who promises moral renewal and new glory and vengeance. And I think we're already seeing that within American society.
So do you see any solutions to this?
Well, all resistance is local now. I mean, the healthcare debate was very depressing window into how corrupt the system is. The for-profit healthcare industry is the problem and has to be destroyed before we can just begin to talk about solutions. But that reality won't be publicly discussed because the industry's money and lobbyists drive the discussion within the press, the mass media. These pharmaceuticals and insurance corporations wrote the 2,000 pages of legislation. It's the most inefficient system in the industrialized world. 33 cents, I think, on every dollar goes to corporate profits. It is legally permitted in this country, in essence, to hold a sick child hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's what we've descended to. And if things deteriorate and if we don't stop both our assault on the environment and the folly of trying to borrow our way out of a crisis, it will. Then you can be sure the elite will take care of themselves. They will retreat into gated communities where they will have access to services, goods, and security that will be denied to the rest of us. And so I think that every movement towards self-sustainability, I think the food movement, becomes crucial. Because they're not going to take care of us. They will use the draconian forms of state security to keep us in check. they're going to take care of us. It will be a reconfiguration of American society along the lines of a kind of modern feudalism. That's what they've done globally. That's why you have large-scale factory closures over the border in Mexico. Everybody's packing up and going to China or Vietnam, where they don't have to pay 90 cents an hour. They can, in southern China, there's many studies, they don't even pay the wages. Workers climb up to the roofs of buildings, collapsing inside these sweatshops from exhaustion, threatening to jump off because they haven't been paid. I mean, it's just awful. And what they're telling the American worker is you have to be competitive in a global marketplace. Well, what they're really saying is you have to be competitive with prison labor. And that's what they've been allowed to do. I mean, I accept capitalism, perhaps not as a virtue, but as a reality. But there are different forms of capitalism. There's the penny capitalism of the farmers in the town where I grew up in upstate New York who brought their produce in to sell. There's the regional capitalism of the small business owner or the hardware store owner who lived in the community and sat on the school board and paid taxes. And then there's corporate capitalism, which is supranational, which is parasitic, which feeds off of the host country and destroys it. And we're watching corporate capitalism, unfettered corporate capitalism, hollow the country out from the inside. Our infrastructure is crumbling. I just took the train up from Portland, and I believe that's a Spanish train, I think. It's a European model. I've been all over Europe. Those trains can, you know, move. I mean, certainly well over 100 miles an hour. But what are we going, probably about 50 or 60 miles an hour because the tracks are no good. I mean, that's just replicated across the country. Our bridges, everything, our public education, everything is being dismantled or neglected and allowed to disintegrate. For what? And that's what corporate capitalism does. They're deeply destructive to the nation.
Do you see the recent passage of the health care bill as a potential talking point one could use with, I mean, it seems like it could be a common ground with, let's say, people who are gravitating to the Tea Party to say, we agree with you, this is a lousy bill, and right, we should tear it apart and start over.
I think the problem is that the working class in this country doesn't trust the liberal establishment at all. And I think they have very good reason not to trust it. While they were getting decimated, the liberal college-educated elite turned their backs on them. And, it's personal for me because much of my family comes out of the working class and from the former mill towns in the state of Maine. And I've watched year after year what's happened to these communities or wrecks. The town where my grandparents are from, even the bank is just boarded up and gone. There's a strip joint in the center of town, methamphetamine clinics all over the labs all over the place. You know, drunken driving and all the stuff that comes when you fall into that kind of despair and desperation. And remembering what it was. And seeing what it's become is, and that's just replicated throughout the United States. So that, all of those forces that had traditionally watched out for the most egregious assaults against working men and women, because they neglected these people, have no credibility at all. And I fully understand why that has happened. So the anger isn't simply directed at Washington or government, but is directed at us. And it should be.
But I thought I heard you say that you don't consider yourself a member of the liberal class.
Well, I'm a product of the liberal class. I grew up in the church, 8 years in university, worked for the New York Times, probably the premier liberal news organization in the country. I was a member of a labor union. We were in a guild, and I was a reporter at the Times. Yeah, finally I positioned myself outside the mainstream liberal establishment. But at the same time, I believe in the importance of liberal institutions, and what they're, when they function, what they're capable of doing. You saw in the civil rights movement that you still had figures within the Democratic Party that could respond to the injustices that were visited on African Americans. Ralph Nader says the last liberal president was Richard Nixon. Not because he was a liberal, but because he passed great consumer legislation, much of it written by Ralph Nader and pushed through Congress by allies in the Democratic Party. And I think we who care about our democracy and civic society forgot that all the correctives to American democracy never achieved formal political power. They all stood outside the power system, whether that was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, labor, civil rights. And we should have held fast to those moral imperatives. Once the Democratic Party, with the passage of NAFTA, began its assault on working men and women, we should have stood with working men and women against the Democratic Party. And we might have been able to protect our country from where we've gone, but we didn't. We continued to support a party that spoke in the language of traditional liberalism and yet carried out one assault after another against the average American. And now we're in big trouble.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of options left. Either one rebuilds the liberal class and honors what it should have been doing all along and makes that very vocal and, you know, carries through on actions, or it sounds like you better run for the hills, because liberals, if you look at, for instance, people like Glenn Beck, are basically putting targets on liberals' backs.
Well, this is, you know, when I talked about the similarities with Yugoslavia, the first thing the ethnic nationalists did was take over the airwaves and pumped out this kind of hate-filled jargon, which Fox News does, and let's not forget which Christian radio and television does, which has hermetically sealed tens of millions of Americans within their embrace. And I, having listened to a lot of this stuff, I encourage everyone who doesn't listen to it, because it's terrifying what they say about homosexuals, what they say about Muslims, what they say about undocumented workers, what they say about liberals, intellectuals. I mean, they have women. There's a pretty long list. And unfortunately, the painting of the liberal class as a target has a degree of validity given the complicity of liberals and the liberal establishment in this assault. And that's why you have Fox News and others trying to tar Barack Obama as not only a liberal but as a socialist, because it discredits the very values that I think could protect us from a descent into a kind of new dark age.
So, to reiterate, your one of your primary solutions you see as bring it local, that if perhaps build our own economies around bartering, things like that.
Yeah.
Is this creating just a different version of the gated communities?
No, because the gated communities are built for the elite, and we don't have the money to build gated communities. The elite can hire people to take care of them. We have to take care of each other. That's the difference.
All right. Well, it sounds pretty bleak.
Well, it is bleak, and you know, I think we can't talk about hope if we can't grasp reality. I was a war correspondent for 20 years. We didn't use words like pessimism or optimism. We figured, I was in Sarajevo, I was getting hit by 2,000 shells a day. People who had a very Pollyannish view of the world didn't live very long. I had a colleague who We called it a thin-skinned vehicle, which means he was driving a normal car. He didn't have an armored like I did. And he spray-painted on the side of his car, "Save your bullets, I'm immortal." And every morning he would drive across the tarmac on the airport that was controlled by the French UN peacekeepers to a Croatian town called Kisiljak to buy cigars and smoke them on the way back as Serb snipers would shoot at him. And he's a cripple now. I have another friend who had that same kind of belief in immortality and stood up in a firefight and shot through the head and was killed. It's our job to very coldly assess reality and then figure out how to respond. And if we have this naive belief that in the inevitability of human progress, or that science and technology will take care of us, or then we're doomed. Essentially we become complicit in our own destruction. So, look, I mean, if you just sit down and read climate change reports, and there's no serious scientist that disputes this, we don't have much time left. I mean, even if we stopped all emissions now, we'd still suffer from the effects of climate change. And yet what are we doing? It's a kind of willful suicide. It's that twilight period that grips civilizations when they just disconnect from what's happening around them. The walls literally go down and they don't see it. I saw that in Sarajevo. I saw it later in Pristina and the war in Kosovo, where people just have an emotional incapacity to grasp how fragile things are and how fast they can deteriorate. So, for instance, in the war in Kosovo, where I was covering the Kosovo Liberation Army, I had friends in Pristina, multilingual, highly educated Kosovo Albanians, very sophisticated people, who kept arguing with me and saying, there won't be a war. They would say the Kosovo Liberation Army doesn't exist. I said, look, I just got stopped at a checkpoint 10 kilometers outside of Pristina by KLA rebel fighters. No, it's just Serb police dressed like that to justify the repression. They literally had no idea what was happening to them until Serb paramilitaries thrust them out of their apartments, shoved them into boxcars on trains, and drove them to refugee camps in Macedonia. And I'm not picking on them because we're no different. For some reason, it's extremely difficult to grasp as societies disintegrate that reality. I covered the fall of East Germany, Czechoslovakia and Romania, and the power elite there was just as oblivious to what was happening, utterly oblivious to what was happening.
I think it's Derek Jensen that has a great line about we would be a lot better off if we would just give up hope.
Well, I know Derek very well. I've debated him, and I think Derek has a lot to say. But my problem with Derek, and this is something that I've been very frank with him about, is that I don't believe he understands violence. I think he romanticizes violence as a mechanism of defense or rebellion. And I intimately know the poison of violence. I'm militantly nonviolent. And I think when I talk about resistance, I think we have to stand up now and carry out acts of nonviolent resistance, because we are that last thin line between a civil democracy and an opposition that, if it's thrust into much more deprivation, will replicate the violence of the state itself. And then we're finished. Then, as Nietzsche said it, we pit our monsters against their monsters. And when I see Tea Party rallies where everyone shows up with weapons, I take it very seriously, because I saw the same thing in Yugoslavia. And those weapons are very rarely used against the state. They're used against helpless scapegoats, undocumented workers, Muslims, anybody who's considered the other. And I share Derek's concern, which he addresses in books like The Culture of Make-Believe and others. And I think our analysis is similar, but we have a radical departure there. And it's why on December 16th, I will go to Washington with Daniel Ellsberg and Medea Benjamin and a few other people and several veterans, and we're going to protest the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, then chain ourselves to the fence of the White House and get arrested. And, because I think that it's incumbent upon those of us at this point to do anything, however futile and it may appear, because otherwise, those forces that are inimical to an open society will triumph. We live in an age, as Yeats wrote, where the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passion and density.
We only have a few minutes left. So you feel like there still is time to change this if people get
I don't know if there's time to change it, but I know that we can't talk about hope if we remain complacent, that hope has to be visible. It has to include severing ourselves as much as possible from the tentacles of the corporate state, and it must include forms of nonviolent resistance. I've done demonstrations in Lafayette Park in front of the White House against the war before, and I can assure you it's a pretty lonely. There's plenty of room, but it doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile. It doesn't invalidate it. You know, if for no other reason than it delivers a message to a grieving mother in Baghdad or Kandahar who's lost their children, or even, you know, young men and women who have been emotionally and physically maimed by war in our own country, that they're not alone. At least they can see they're not alone. And, you know, I fall back on my seminary training that we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and that it's not our job to determine where good goes. We trust that it goes somewhere. We believe that it does. But we can't know. And I think we live in an age when it isn't an imperative where all of us who care about maintaining a peaceful and an open society begin to carry out these kinds of acts, even if they're lonely acts, and not put our trust into bankrupt power structures like the Democratic Party, which are non-reformable. I mean, not one senator or member of the House supported the public option. Not one. Not Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Not Dennis Kucinich. Not Conyers, who had written the single-payer bill. Not one of them. And I think that utter capitulation is a window into how broken the system is.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. So I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
We have just been talking with Chris Hedges. He is author of the new book, The Death of the Liberal Class.